Here's the last of the trilogy. That's the Barnett case, Marriage of Barnett. May I proceed?
Lower this real quick for us vertically challenged people. Doesn't go much lower. May it please the court?
Counsel?
Paul LaRue, 35987, on behalf of the petitioner Aaron Barnett, who is also the ex-husband in this case. I appreciate the court's time. It's actually been a benefit sitting in the back, being able to listen to the previous arguments. I'll go ahead and quickly touch on the facts of my case. In my particular case, the parties were pro se at the inception of their case. The petition for dissolution was filed in October of 2002. The parties proceeded in front of the magistrate in and around February of 2003. The initial appearance in front of the magistrate did not feel comfortable entering into a decree at that point in time. She felt that each party, or more particularly the wife, should seek independent counsel. She gave them time to seek independent counsel. They returned in front of the magistrate in and around March of 2003, at which point in time, Ms. Barnett advised that she had consulted with an attorney. At that point in time, the court entered its decree. So as of March of 2003, this case was, for all intents and purposes, finished.
That was the final order.
That was the final decree, yes, ma'am. March of 2003.
Okay.
Then what had occurred is wife, after 2003, some 26 months after March 2003, filed a motion to modify child support and maintenance. At that point in time, Mr. Barnett retained our office as his counsel, and we proceeded. Ms. Shively, who was the trial attorney in that case, once the motion was filed after 2005, which was the enactment of 16.2, Mr. Barnett, through his attorney, submitted a 16.2 financial affidavit. Within that financial affidavit, Ms. Shively discovered that there was a FERS pension plan. My client is employed as now a supervisor with the FAA and has a FERS pension plan as well as a thrift savings plan. As part of the original separation agreement and subsequent decree, the thrift savings plan was divided. Now, there is a subject of dispute. My client claims he did advise his wife of the pension orally and that she had told him that she didn't want anything to do with his pension, he could have it. Unfortunately, the parties being pro se, that was not memorialized in writing. So it was not, and I will concede to this court, it was not subject to the decree, and it wasn't in his financial affidavit insofar as specifically allocated as an asset. The reason I say that is factually, you may have equities, but this case is contingent upon the legalities, the legal issues in this case. Unfortunately, every day in the legal system, people lose the ability to seek a right. People lose out on non-claim statutes, statutes of repose, and even some instances, statutes of limitation. Their rights are extinguished. It's sad. It happens. In this instance, under the case law at that point in time, in March of 2003, wife had until in and around September of 2003 to bring a CRCP 60B2 motion to set aside the decree for any sort of fraudulent activity, extrinsic or intrinsic. Wife failed to do that. So in this instance, as of September 2003, the case was finished. Husband had a vested right in his FERS pension plan as of that point in time. Now, the issue becomes when she files her post-decree motion. And I believe Justice Rice made an excellent point, and I even think I heard Justice Hobbs and Justice Martinez. I think that the fascinating thing is, me as a young attorney especially, I make these arguments, then I come and I hear some of these arguments, and I think they're very poignant, which is if we look at 16.2E10, and let's really look at what that language specifically says, and I think that actually answers our question. The first sentence says, as set forth in this section, meaning referring to 16.2. It is the duty of the parties to an action for decree of dissolution, legal separation, or invalidity of marriage to provide full disclosure of all marital assets and liabilities. If the disclosure contains misstatements or omissions, now, if the disclosure, the disclosure this is referring to is as set forth in this section. So the disclosure it's referring to that you have the right to bring an action within 5 years is the disclosures as set forth in 16.2. What's missing is it doesn't say, for instance, as set forth in this section and the previous rule 26.2, nor does it say if the disclosure as set forth in this section and 26.2 contains a misstatement or omission, the court shall have jurisdiction. So what is our position is that this section in and of itself doesn't even apply to our case because, or my case in particular, because 26.2 were the disclosures that controlled when my case was decided or the decree was entered and the parties were actually moving through the decree of dissolution of marriage. So therefore, you don't even actually get to invoke this particular subsection in my case because it's not applicable. 26.2 was applicable. And in fact, if you look at the committee notes to 16.2, it specifically makes a mention. Rules, it says, it is the intent of the committee that relevant case law under 26.2 or 26 will have precedential value. Under the previous rule 26.2, there was not a temporal limitation or any sort of available avenue for a party to reopen a divorce. What the court had decided...
Well, was there some standard about material omissions or not?
There was not. And in fact, if you look at the committee notes to 26.2, what it talks about in the committee notes under mandatory automatic disclosures, it says that in a domestic... It says, the presumptive limitations on discovery in CRCP 26 have been slightly increased due to the nature of the fiduciary relationship between the parties in a domestic relations matter. Since the issues in a domestic relations matter are not framed specifically in the pleadings as they are in civil litigation, automatic mandatory disclosure of every fact or document that may be relevant was deemed inappropriate and too burdensome and cumbersome for the parties. So at that time, the court recognized that perhaps people in a domestic case sit in a different position. They did not feel it was important at that time to implement anything different as far as a limitation for someone to reopen a decree. Subsequently, in case law said that 60B, along with the other civil matters, controls when somebody seeks to reopen a decree of dissolution of marriage. So in this instance, 60B2, which wife has pled, and I believe wife has acknowledged in her pleadings, that 60B2, if it controlled, she would have been barred or precluded. And I think it brings up an interesting hypothetical. In a case, let's take for instance our case, March 2003, the decree enters. Wife files a motion, let's say she discovered this January of 2004. She files a motion to reopen the divorce in January of 2004. The trial court would have summarily dismissed it because it was beyond the 6 months that she had within which to bring that action. Now, wife, with the enactment of 16.2 and the Court of Appeals interpretation, could actually refile another motion to reopen, and the court would say, yep, now you can reopen it because of the five-year look-back provision. I don't think that promotes judicial efficiency. I also think it promotes people's rights to finality. I think dissolution of marriage cases have this underlying tone of getting the people separated and finished and moving forward with their lives and having a final order, something they can rely on to be finished. And in this instance, at that point in time, the 6 months controlled and they had finality within which to move on with their lives. Having the ability to then come back and open this after 5 years does not promote that. It actually surprises husband in this instance. And what's interesting also is I think the court, I believe Justice Malarkey had made a point about, well, procedural versus substantive. How do we look at procedural versus substantive? Sometimes it's not that easy. Simply because a rule is set forth in, or law is set forth in a rule, doesn't necessarily mean it's procedural. And I guess the way that I look at it, procedural rules, they do set forth deadlines, but they also offer flexibility. And I'll give an example. I mean, everybody's heard of the Todd versus Bear Valley case and the progeny of the cases that have decided that. In that, we're talking about procedural issues, disclosure of witnesses. You go through and you can look at 16.2. You have 30 days and 60 days. 30 days to disclose witnesses, 60 to disclose expert witnesses. Are those set firmly? Well, the Todd versus Bear Valley case says, well, not really. Let's look at kind of the balancing issues, and then let's look at discretion, and let's see how people's particular behavior. But we can kind of bend those rules a little bit. 60B2, as it was in place in our case, and nowhere will you find a case that says 60B2 can be bent, manipulated, told, anything along those lines. 60B2 was 6 months. If you didn't bring it under Garvillis and the other cases, it was over. You had no right to do that. So in my opinion, that is within a rule, but it's substantive because it bars somebody, it precludes somebody from bringing something else. Same with 16.2E10. It clearly sets forth a five-year limitation. Again, based on my argument in the beginning, I don't think 16.2 even controls by the plain reading of the statute. By looking at that statute, you can see that it talks about the disclosure within this section. When my client filled out his financial affidavit, it was a 26.2 financial affidavit. With the 26.2 financial affidavit, they changed substantively, quite differently. The 16.2 financial affidavit is now different. So, in my opinion, I think that's dispositive, and we don't get past that. So, therefore, I think the Court of Appeals did err in the instance of applying this particular subsection to our case. And I'd just like to reserve the rest of the time for people, if there are any further questions.
Amen.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Your Honors, Counsel. There's no doubt in this case that we're asking the court.
Excuse me, could you just state
I'm
your
sorry,
name
Your
for
Honor.
The record?
My name is Jennifer Motichka, and I am the attorney for the appellee, Ms. Barnett. You know, I don't think there's any question regarding this case that we are asking the court to apply 16.2E10 in a retroactive manner. In looking at that, however, Your Honors, I don't believe that by applying it retroactively that we're applying it retrospectively. Your Honor, the provisions of 16E10 provide a greater remedy for people like Ms. Barnett. Now, this case is not quite as simple as counsel set forth. The parties were pro se. The parties had a duty to disclose under 26.2 at that time. I've heard a lot of argument today that 26.2 was probably a lesser standard of disclosure than 16.2, that 16.2 is now a heightened standard. But the bottom line, Your Honor, is that both disclosure standards came from the parties' fiduciary duties to each other as a marital couple. That's where the duties to disclose stem from, is that idea. Your Honor, in 26.2, the case, the law required the parties to make disclosures. The financial affidavit was actually more complicated than the current financial affidavit under 16.2. In addition, 26.2 did require the parties to exchange pension information, which was relevant in this case. There was no pension information exchanged from the parties but for a statement. There was no information given or exchanged from the parties regarding the FERS pension account. The only information given was the information regarding the defined benefit plan or the defined contribution plan, not the defined benefit plan. You know, that asset wasn't even addressed at permanent orders. It wasn't divided. It wasn't created or put into a column that became vested at a later time. It was not, in my opinion, a vested right. Certainly, Mr. Barnett had an interest in that pension with his employer. But in terms of the divorce case, it wasn't divided. It was not accounted for. Your Honors.
How does that actually work? Explain that to me. I mean, it's just accounted for as an asset, right?
Excuse me,
pension
Your Honor?
Plan. Tell me how it works in practice.
In terms of dividing pension plans?
Right.
We have two types of pension plans, Your Honor, and they're divided. You have a defined benefit plan and a defined contribution plan. Both those plans are divided pursuant to qualified domestic relations orders that are issued in conjunction with the permanent orders that are entered in a case, in terms of either how the parties agree by stipulation or how the court orders the division of that asset to be. In this case, there were no orders dividing that asset. And when we take a look, Your Honors, in terms of whether or not the statute or the law, the rule is retrospective in nature, the first thing we have to look at is, does it impair a vested right? Well, as I discussed, I don't think that the pension was a vested right in and of itself, and certainly Mr. Barnett did not have a vested right in a remedy. 16.2E10 created a new remedy. If we look at CRS 14-10-122, that statute talks about, you know, property divisions being final, only subject being reopened pursuant to the rule for reopening of property divisions. That rule does not limit, or the statute does not limit, how the court can do that. It doesn't say that we can only set it aside pursuant to 60B2.
May I interrupt you right there just one second? And this has created a little problem for me. We're talking a lot about disclosures, but back up just a little bit on the point about 60B now that you're talking about. It appears yours seems to be the clearest case. I've got all the dates of these three cases all mixed up, so I could have them wrong. But yours seems to be a clear case in which, but for this rule and the applicability of this rule, you couldn't be in court. Is that right? On a post-trial motion.
Under 60B2, that's correct, Your Honor.
So you're relying on the applicability of 16.2, C4, I guess, for you to be able to file a post-trial motion now at all, because you had been cut off before this rule was passed. Is that not right?
I think in terms of filing, it's not cut off pursuant to Rule 16. I think the remedy offered by 60B was cut off, 60B2 was cut off after 6 months had expired. That remedy was gone.
Okay.
But I think the new rule created another remedy.
The new rule meaning 16.2?
16.2E10, yes, Your Honor.
Right. But for you to come in and seek that remedy, do you have to rely on C4 that says you can file a post-conviction motion at any time? What's the basis for you filing a motion to seek relief under 16E10?
Based upon the non-disclosure or the incomplete disclosure and the omission mm-hmm. of assets.
But that presumes then the applicability of this motion to get you into court. This is not a situation in which you would have been permitted to get into court on a post-trial motion anyway, and now you're relying on this new rule to make up for omissions or non-disclosures. You've got to rely on this rule to even get into court at this point in time. Is that right?
Given the ruling that 60B5 did not apply, yes.
And so you're relying on the language in the effective date clause that says it applies and for post-decree motions filed on or after January 1st, 2005, to mean since you filed after 2005, it applies to you and it allows you to file at any time. Is this not a kind of a circular problem?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I think by creating the statute, the court rectified the issue of the limitation of remedies that was imposed by 60B2 by creating another remedy, an alternative remedy in 16.2.
Would that same argument, I realize that with regard to the omissions and non-disclosures, we get a 5-year retained jurisdiction under, you know, 16E10. But with regard to the language that allows you to file a post-trial motion, a post-decree motion under C4, does that mean then anybody in the world could now file because who had an unfavorable ruling at some point in time in one of these decrees in the past, that now since it's past January 1, 2005, they could file a post-decree motion?
I think it has to be within 5 years from the date of...
Well, it does for you to get a remedy for omission or non-disclosure.
Correct, Your Honor.
But doesn't it say you could file a post-decree motion at any time?
Well, post-decree motion...
Is there any other reason why one would file a post-decree motion?
Well, there's a lot of other post-decree motions, John. Mm-hmm. There's motions to modify child support.
Mm-hmm.
There's motions to modify parenting time. There's motions to enforce rights. There's a lot of motions you can file post-decree.
And it really doesn't matter about more than 5 years or less than 5 years, because you're within the five-year period with regard to your case. But I only raise it to ask the question, is there a, do you need some kind of procedural vehicle to get into court to be able to seek this relief?
The procedural vehicle in this case, Your Honor, was 16E10.
Okay.
The statute allows for post-trial motions, and that's exactly what was done in this case, what the trial court found. That was the mechanism. I think it created a new remedy.
And your position in that regard would be that the committee itself looked at 60. They were concerned about the operation of 60.
They were concerned about the operation of 60, Your Honor. In fact, in the committee notes, there was discussion about whether the rule can preempt Rule 60B. In addition, Your Honor, there was discussion about, there was some concern about whether or not how the applicability in terms of how far back the look-back period would be, whether it applied to just cases arising after the adoption of the new rule. And in light of those concerns, the language that was used in 16.2 is what we see today. It includes new cases and post-trial motions filed after January 1st, 2005.
But the stumbling block still is what Justice Martinez pointed out originally, and that is that first sentence and the reference to full disclosure of all material assets and liabilities, and whether that's a new provision or an existing provision.
In terms of a new obligation, Your Honor?
Yes, because, you know, your case has to go back to the original disclosure.
26.2.
Yeah.
In 26.2, Your Honor, it did require the disclosure of pension information. It did require disclosure of all that on the financial affidavit. There's also an independent provision regarding the disclosure of pension information under 26.2. I don't believe that 16.2 created a huge heightened responsibility or duty to produce documents. I think it's procedural in nature. It didn't, it created a new remedy. It didn't divest anyone of any vested rights. And certainly Mr. Barnett didn't have a vested right in the remedy. It created a new way for this court to address the concern and limitations that were imposed by 60B2. Your Honor, counsel touched upon the issue of non-claim statutes. I don't think that 60B2 could be found in any way to be a non-claim statute. Non-claim statutes generally deal with things like probate cases, and the Governmental Immunity Act, which sets forth a very specific standard for giving notice, giving the other party an opportunity to respond, which aren't contained in 60B2 at all or any provision of 60B. 60B is not a non-claim rule. 60B is just a remedy. It's one remedy which was supplemented by the new rule 16.2. And Your Honors, I believe that it's proper for this court to look at it that way. Previous to the adoption of 16.2, we had a problem in terms of rectifying non-disclosures, in terms of rectifying fraud. And which was, I think, in this particular type of case, a dissolution of marriage case, where you have a heightened duty of fiduciary responsibility to each other, didn't fit with what we thought or what we believe that how the parties should deal with each other in that situation. Marriage is a unique situation, circumstance, and 60B didn't address the needs or the issues that would come up with that. And I believe that the specific clear language of 16.2E10 allows for the remedy that Ms. Barnett sought and the trial court of appeals gave her. And again, Your Honors, this is a case where it was a complete omission of an asset. There was no division of the FERS account. It was not given to either party. It was not disclosed. And it's proper for this court to uphold the decision of the court of appeals in this case. That's all I have, Your Honors, unless you have any other questions.
I think when you look at the totality, insofar as the first prong of the test, retroactive application. Retroactive application, we need to look at the intent of the drafters of the language, which would be the Supreme Court Committee and also the Supreme Court. I think it's kind of awkward that I'm arguing what your intent may be in this case. However, I think if you look at the totality of this, and you look at the language that I pointed out with respect to 16.2b10, and it's saying as set forth in this section, if disclosure, referring to that. I think when you look at that, I don't think there is a clear intent here for 16.2 to be able to reopen something that's been extinguished or precluded or barred by 60b2. Especially if you look at the committee notes. The committee notes talk about 26.2 having precedential value. So again, we're adding more to the totality of looking at it. The next thing that you could look at is you could look at the committee notes from the Supreme Court committee draft. I believe it was in May of 2003 when they speak to the issues about Rule 60 and the conflict with Rule 60. They begin further on to talk about it in the August 1st, 2003. Concerns have been expressed under these new case procedures. Financial disclosures are primary voluntary, and that after the expiration of Rule 60. And going back to back to May 23, 2003, the committee notes, the committee decided this would be best addressed by the Supreme Court when it decides this new rule. As set forth in my opening brief, 16.2 was a serious endeavor. It was something that had to be researched, put a lot of time and effort into it. They did a wonderful job setting forth all of these new things to help with the running smoothly of cases in dissolution of marriage. As a practicing attorney in dissolution of marriage, you need some sort of court intervention, some sort of structure in these cases. However, what was added to this, which was different than any previous rule, was now a look-back provision under 16.2. Again, it goes back to procedural versus substantive. I think that in and of itself is a substantive provision. I do think that 60b2 was a substantive right. It wasn't something that Ms. Matichik talks about as simply a remedy. It's not a limitation of action. It's not found in the limitation of action. The way that I believe it can be distinguished is a limitation of action or a statute of limitations, they deal with somebody's right to go into court to address a situation where they have been aggrieved, initiating a case, commencing a case. That's not the case with 60b2. It's referring to a case that has been finished and an order has been entered. It specifically says in 60b2 that you have no time can be brought later than 6 months. It must be brought within 6 months of the order. The case law that has interpreted that says you don't bring it within that 6 months, that right, it's extinguished, it's gone, it's precluded and it's barred. If you do specifically look at the case law regarding non-claim statutes, it talks about how a non-claim statute can be viewed, and it talks insofar as distinguishing a non-claim statute. It says that non-claim statutes are not subject to other legislative provisions which provide in special circumstances the periods of time for filing actions defined by general statutes of limitations can be extended. Can't be extended. Non-claims, if you don't bring it, you lose it. It is for a contractual term, it's a condition precedent. The condition precedent in this case is 6 months. You had 6 months, September of 2003 came and went, it was extinguished, it was gone. Thank you.
It seems like the whole intent of this marital statute really is to be fair and be gone.
Finality, absolutely.
Yeah, but we're talking about the fairness here.
Well,
not just the be gone.
Just the be gone.
Right? Isn't that right?
I appreciate the fact, yes, that we are talking about fairness, equitable, equities in those instances. Yes. However, we at that point in time when the statute, when our case was proceeding through the courts, the decree was entered, 60b2 was in place. And as I stated earlier in my argument, it happens every day. It's unfortunate, but people lose out because of certain statutes of limitation, statutes of repose, or non-claim statutes bar that right.
Thank you.
Thank you.
On behalf of the court, I thank you, counsel, for your arguments, and the case will stand submitted. The court will be in recess until 9 tomorrow morning.